Conversations with Friends is a new series.
A series within a series.
Creative conversations between writer friends.
We were blown away by the calibre of the pitches we received from established mid-career debut and emerging writers.
From those writing poetry, fiction, non-fiction, plays, newsletters and PhDs.
Conversations to get you through these strange COVID days and beyond.
Sit back, stay home and enjoy. This episode of Conversations with Friends is with Sean O'Bairn and Wayne Marshall. Sean O'Bairn is a bookseller and critic. He grew up in Melbourne's outer suburbs and studied arts, law and acting. A Couple of Things Before the End is his first book.
Wayne Marshall's stories have appeared in Going Down Swinging, Kill Your Darlings, Island, Review of Australian Fiction and many more places. His short story collection, Sherl, was shortlisted for the 2019 Victorian Premier's Literary Award for an unpublished manuscript and was published this year by Affirm Press. He is the co-founder of the Peter Carey Short Story Award and lives in regional Victoria with his partner and two daughters.
This week, two short story collections, two debuts, two blogs.
Two blogs.
We haven't had as many males apply for the Conversations with Friends series, have we?
No, well, they don't talk like we talk, do they? Like women talk, isn't that the general theory? Making sweeping generalisations on the podcast.
Well, maybe semi-linked. I found the discussion about the way that sport and the culture of sport looms so large in Australia really fascinating.
Yeah, that's true. I really liked that too.
Is your family a big sporting family?
They are. My extended family and my little nuclear family here too are all quite sport obsessed. Me not so much, but all of them, yes, deeply involved in the culture of Australian sport. How about you, Catherine?
To a degree, all sport participants, but less. I think when I think of sport, and this is something these guys mentioned as well, I think footy really in Australia, which varies depending what state you're in. But I think it's Sean that points out that everywhere else or in other countries, if you go to Europe, for example, you have competing cultural sort of systems and institutions that are on the same scale. But really, I think Australia doesn't have that to the same extent, does it?
No, maybe that's why we're getting such great stats with people reading at the moment, just because there's no football.
What is happening with reading? Are they getting...
Well, I keep on seeing... I think it's really tricky because I think people, you know, you want to hear good news stories. So I think there's a lot of advertising of publishers who are saying, yes, we're up slightly, or yes, we're getting this record, a number of people reading. But who knows? But people must be doing something when they're not going to the football. That's a lot of people. I really loved in here that once in a lifetime fall in your lap kind of story that Wayne tells at the end, which is so gorgeous. And Chrissy Neen talks about this kind of wonder in some of her projects in an upcoming episode as well. Have you ever had one of those magical stories or pieces that come out fully formed, Catherine?
I'm still waiting for my magical piece. I thought my second novel would be my magical piece. I just was like, this one's going to write itself, but it's
not so much.
It's proved slightly more challenging than that. But I remain hopeful. Number three.
Well, you get it at some point. Isn't that the deal? Like you get it at least once in your life. So maybe you want it at a different time. Maybe you this just isn't the right time.
And have you used yours up?
Potentially, even though it was on a picture book manuscript, which is very small and as yet unpublished, but it was one of those like scribbled down on the back of something in its entirety vomit kind of a thing. And then it appeared to be done. Obviously you go back and edit the things, but it was like a gift of a story. But I love the way that Wayne talks about it.
I also like the idea of figuring out what your starting problem is. Do you think thematically you just circle the same kind of topics?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think there are just a handful of things that really you seek to dissect from many different angles and perspectives and through different eyes.
Which lots of people say things about this, but that idea of don't walk away from your obsession. Like if it's your obsession, just come back to it.
Oh, that's one cool thing Shorten talks about is the so he's got an acting background, really sort of strength is voice. Strength is not the sun is yellow today kind of description thing, but talking about how you can bring in a view of the scene or a more holistic perspective of something through voice, yeah, which I've never really thought about.
Yeah. I thought that a lot of, as I was listening to him, I'm like, Catherine's going to be getting down on this because of the comedy and that same stuff about improv, which Sarah talked about as well, and the way of coming at problems and story from that way. I thought that was really interesting.
Hello and welcome to the First Time podcast in the special Conversations with Friends series. My name is Wayne Marshall. I'm a writer who released my debut short story collection, Sherl, about 3 months ago now through Affirm Press. And tonight I will be speaking with...
Sean O'Byrne.
Yes. Sorry.
Yes. Do I talk now? Is it me?
Yeah, I think you should talk now, Sean. Yeah.
It's me, Sean O'Byrne, and I'm the author of the short story collection, A Couple of Things Before the End.
Brilliant. And who's that out with through, Sean?
That's out through Black Ink.
Fantastic. So where should we start? This has been a chat a long time in the making. Where do we even start?
And listeners, this kind of professionalism, this kind of smooth interaction is what you're going to get for the next 30 minutes. Just get a sense of just how smooth and professional this is really going to be. So stay right here. Don't go anywhere else.
Strap yourselves in. So, Sean, would you like to start with anything?
Yes. I have a start question. And one of the things I was, and we've had a chance to talk a little, but one of the things I was really looking forward to do with this was just a chance to ask another writer sort of those you don't usually get to ask at event type things, some of which are maybe a bit more, I don't know, personal or embarrassing or amateurish. And the thing I really wanted to start by asking was, what are your memories of really making the first attempts to write? It's often something, again, that you don't get to talk about in a public event with an audience because, I mean, people sort of want to press on. But I think one of the things about it is such a nervous and a strange and a good time when you really do start to make the first sort of attempt and you find yourself, to your surprise, not giving up. And I wonder, what are your memories of that like?
Yeah, well, there was a long, long period of trying without success and then giving up. My first love was music, so I played in bands from when I was 15, and I wrote the lyrics for those bands. So that was my sort of introduction to writing. I didn't start with prose fiction until early 20s, and I wrote for the next 10 years. I tried to write a novel as part of a creative writing degree, and it was just a struggle. I couldn't get down what I wanted to get down. A lot of my stories have quite fantastical elements, and they did even back then. And I couldn't ground them. There was no reality to the stories. You know, they lack that bringing into proper fiction. We've sort of emailed a little bit about Sean of the details and the depth. And so I actually quit writing in 2010, 2011, and I didn't come back for a few years. So that's how well my first decade of trying went. How about you?
I didn't even properly start until I was in my mid-30s. Like, I didn't even make a proper concentrated attempt until I was in my mid-30s. I'm a late starter. So I was interested in comedy. When I was an undergraduate, I was in comedy. You know, I was in comedy shows. Like, I performed in sketch comedy. I was in comedy reviews, and then I went to acting school, which was partly a way to. Now I can understand it was a way to get ready to write, but at the time I was just confused. I think it was the nearest thing to comedy I could find. But I was the joke on me was I was pretty bad dramatic actor. I was a pretty bad just straightforward actor from the get go, and I would often draw unintentional laughs in Shakespeare or in Ibsen. I would be standing up. I've told this story to people before, but I was once in a show where we had to, it was very serious sort of movement piece avant-garde piece, and we really did have to reenact a painting, a romantic painting by this painter called Jericho, and we really did have to shave our heads and wear a smock and move around the stage. And I opened this, you know, avant-garde movement performance at drama school, so I had to come out in front of the audience.
Oh wow!
And with my head shaved, with my smock, and the line, I'll never forget this, was, "I don't know what to do." Right, that was my line. I had to come out and say that, right? And I would come out and give that line, and there would just be this answering titter of amusement from the audience. You know, it's supposed to be this like heavy, very quite serious romantic piece, you know, romantic dramatic piece. And yeah. I would come out and say that, "I don't know what to do," and there would just be this little answering. So that was hard because I had a self-consciousness, and I experienced myself as ridiculous, or what, and this is interesting for fiction later, what I couldn't do was make a kind of amount of belief that I needed to believe. I didn't believe that I was the captain. I didn't believe that I was the guard. I didn't believe that I was these people, whoever I wanted, was supposed to be.
Yeah, I understand that.
But at least later, at least later on, I think that I didn't understand this for a long time, but the benefit was it did at least deliver me out of something which was more like my suburban upbringing into just the sheer sort of outrageousness or the amount of maybe pretension you have to get closer to if you're going to produce any art or writing. So at least it got me used to the idea of doing these things. I think half my problem at drama school was I was just so, I don't know, taken aback by even what we were trying to do. I was just sort of unused to that kind of, I don't know, that kind of, the sort of the size and the amount of that kind of commitment to making art. I just think it took me at least two tries to even get near it. But that's interesting. Like, go back to the music, because I heard Zadie Smith say once in a broadcast that a lot of people who end up writing have this, where they have a sort of a second thing that they tried and they could do it kind of, and they felt like a bit of an imposter. And your job sometimes is to push through the first amount of art attempt and get into the second one. Is that how you felt a bit with music?
Yeah, I mean, to a degree. So as I said, I was with the band and we put out a few albums, and I was the main lyricist and one of a few singers. And I kind of destroyed the band by heading further into concept album territory, I guess. Like the lyrics became to totally dominate the music. It became super narrative driven. It became vocals, no let up from the vocals, telling a story. And I became frustrated at it not doing what I wanted it to do. I wanted it to become more theatrical. So I guess I reached a bit of an end point with music, where I'd always been interested in writing prose fiction, and the songs had taken on such a narrative element that it kind of seems it's quite a seamless step into concentrating on the fiction. But the same with you, that element of performance of you know, I'm from outer suburban Melbourne, and that thing of being on a stage and becoming someone else, that taste of what fiction can give you when it's really working, of total, like a really transcendental experience of becoming someone else, and in such a performative aspect, which, you know, I got a real thrill from and I still tap into with the writing.
Huh, that's so nice. Look at that, your sort of truer art amount coming through, even though you didn't know it was, right? You were almost trying to write while you were doing the damn songs.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, I miss music a little bit. I never found that I could do two things at once. I need to do one. I don't know about you. Have you ever gone back to acting or anything? No. Stage performance?
No, I feel the same way you do, and I'm sometimes bad at giving advice to people because I come up against and I'm confused by people who can do more than one thing. Partly because I started so late, I'm sort of tense about it too. Like, I feel like I was lucky to recognize that I really had to concentrate on one thing. I'd been trying around for a long time, and at least by my mid to late 30s, I was beginning to understand the ways in which I would really have to reorganize my life for this activity. It was hard enough to do that. I can't imagine what it would be like, and this just goes to my personality and character. I just found it hard enough to really organize my time and to pay attention in the way I needed to pay attention for writing. The idea that I could do a second art activity as well, get in some way good enough at something else, I can't imagine it. But I do, as you say, I do feel the price or cost of it a bit. It would be some relief and maybe good for me in other ways to have some other thing. But I really have found that it's pretty much just work, some social, like work for money, some social life, and then writing. But at least, I don't know, the other thing, the sort of upside down thing to say about that is I've enjoyed understanding that I should become narrower, and that odd sort of training like pleasure of feeling it as a frustration that you can't do other things. But then, you know, after the second hour of doing the thing that you're making yourself doing, thinking, oh, I wouldn't be doing anything else, you know, getting the odd reward from just paying attention to the same thing over and over.
I know exactly what you mean. And it seems like you have to come into a certain period of your life to be able to be okay with that narrowing, I think.
Yeah.
Time has to be right, doesn't it? Like, you know, it's such a commitment. It's such a commitment. And, you know, it's amazing. But the days when it's really flying are quite few. So, you know, to buy that commitment is a big ask. I mean, you mentioned before that coming out of, you know, into your 30s and deciding that you'd like to write but not having that kind of commitment. I mean, what changed for you? What was the starting point of you starting to work in prose fiction?
I think it was something to do with, and this would be true, I reckon, for lots of people who write. I'm going to ask you if it's true for you too, but I think it would be one of the reasons anybody might get stuck writing is because there really is, they find, no other work that's going to make them figure out something like what their starting problem is. I was thinking today when I was thinking about trying to say something about this, it's like it's odd. You almost set yourself an odd kind of homework. You keep going and you realize, I was quite moved in your book in that story where you describe, and I don't know if this is literal autobiography, but you describe yourself getting out of a truck to scribble down ideas for stories.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Right? That's in, is it in Levitation?
That's in Levitation. Yeah. I had it when I tried to write a novel and it just fell apart, and I had, like, honestly, a bit of a, it was a tough time. And I went away, I was in Melbourne at the time, and moved out to Baxter Marsh, where I am now, and took a job reading electricity meters in the Macedon Ranges, driving a truck around the place. And it was just exactly what I needed at that time. It was so, it was a really solitary thing, but out in nature, it was really beautiful. And I really did try to quit writing to be something that I'd purged from me. I'd had enough of it. But pretty soon into that job, I was pulling over at the sides of dirt roads in state forest, writing ideas for stories. I just couldn't get rid of it, it drove me. And so that was really the start of the collection. You know, this is 2012-ish, and pulling over the sides of the road like that, it's an addiction. It's an obsession and addiction. You would know this. That's the trap of being a writer, I think. Once you fall into it, once you take all the stuff on that we've been talking about, that commitment, you can't just let it go easily. It's there all the time. It's not something that you can sign off from. I find that anyway. How about you?
No. I wanted to ask you this because, and this might be going too far, but there's maybe something underneath this, and it wouldn't necessarily come out in writing. It would come out in other things too, which is the start, again, this idea of the starting problem. So there's something about being whoever you are, wherever you are, with whoever you're with, and it sets you some sort of problem, you know, that I'm not like, I can't do what most of the people around me think is good. I can't do what most of the people around me think I should do. That doesn't make me better than them, but it does set me a special kind of problem. And it strikes me that, like, it could be music, yes, but writing is one of the ways you slowly get to work on that problem. And I think that we talked about this a little bit. So many of the stories in your collection are about doing this, about saying, I don't want to be where I am, but also using writing as a way to work out the ways in which you are like the people around you, that you don't want to be too far apart from them. I think so much writing so much fiction, so much story is about people sort of working through that, their first alienation and then some sort of need to return, if that makes sense.
I think that very articulate, Sean, that makes a lot of sense. Absolutely. Like for me, out where I grew up, it was a town that gravitated around the football club. And I was there, like my dad was heavily involved and I was there and I was part of that world, but I didn't ever feel truly part of it. With a desire to make art, you know this yourself, it's the sort of the sporting world and art in Australia don't sit too well together. So there was an alienation at that point, I think, which absolutely is probably at the root of a lot of the stuff that I've written in my book. I mean, what about you? You have so many stories that, as I was saying to you today, that they sort of start off as not an attack, but certainly a satire on a culture and particularly the first half of the book, the sort of the ochre white Australian male culture. And it begins as a satire, almost a piss take of the characters and the language they use. But there is a deepening that occurs into the stories and you begin to really feel for these people. And I can see a complexity in the way, I sense a complexity, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the way you feel towards that problem as well. I don't know if you want to speak to that.
No, hopefully. One of the reasons I wanted to get out of comedy or found comedy hard is that it you get the pleasure of attack. You get the pleasure of some good revenge, right? You can set up the people that you grew up around that frightened you or hurt you when you were younger. Yeah. And you can impersonate them and the audience rolls back and forth. It's good. But then what, in a way, what are you going to keep doing? You know, there's a real sameness to it. You sort of make the same move over and over. You point and you show that they're ridiculous. The thing I've come to really love about fiction, I think, as far as I understand it, is fiction does make you go on after that. And it makes you start to bend back towards the people and it forces you into this, because fiction's always, as far as I understand it, making you notice as much as you can notice in a way that comedy doesn't, right? Comedy, you notice an amount, yeah? Good for laughs. Yeah, sort of stop there. But fiction makes you keep noticing. And sooner or later, I found that I was noticing that the person I was setting up to make fun of was also afraid of things that I was afraid of. Like there's that story in the book, A Night with the Fellas.
Yeah.
Which is about a kind of bloke getting up to give the kind of speech that you would give at a mate's 21st or a bucks night or like a footy awards night speech, which you must have heard a few of. And like I, as you say, I grew up with blokes like that. In some ways, I couldn't like be like them. They bored and frightened me in some ways. And you know what it's like when you're 13, 14, that stuff is too much of your world. The fact that you basically can't run along with the footy blokes, it can do you. You know, I mean, I know movies and stuff make a lot of the pain of adolescence, but that stuff can really, you know, cruel or warp a lot of your life, especially in Australia too. We have a special problem in Australia because the sports culture here is so disproportionately large compared to any other culture in the world. You know, we run, as your book brings out so beautifully in so many ways, that just the sheer amount of sport, right? Sport as... When you go to Europe, one thing you get a sense of almost right away is that there are competing systems that are almost as large.
Yeah.
You know, that books and literature are almost as large. The history and culture of music is almost as large. Here, everything else shrinks down and this damn gas giant sport, you know, is the only damn planet in the solar system.
Yeah, exactly.
But now all this is just talk of the resentment of it. But fiction made me look at a bloke who could have been the bloke who was the best and fairest, or the captain of the damn team, and I don't know, call off some of that first dislike, and make me hopefully understand something like, or work towards something like, we all have to run a personality. All of us have to hide something, defend ourselves against something. And you're right, I did feel an odd kind of affection by the end of working on some of the stories, which was, because of course it's in me too. I'll still stand somewhere and go, you know, I'll say no worries 25 times a day. There's ways in which I'm marked by the way that culture, God bless it, Australian male working class culture, the ways in which you express reassurance or defend yourself, it's in me too. So it was again, a good working through, a good recognition to find it.
And your stories are so voice driven. They're a lot of them, like there's so many different. I'd love to ask you about the formal experimentation if we can get time in a minute. But
yeah,
voice wise, they take different forms. There's some as written formally as in an email, some in internet comments, and some directly as speeches. But the whole lot give a feel. They're not only performative. These stories, to me, feel like they're meant to be read aloud, but they feel like actual speeches. So the language of that culture you were just talking about, I mean, you have to be so enmeshed in that culture because it's so true. The language is so precise and so brutal and so funny at the same time in capturing that culture. So I guess, you know, that thing as well about beyond just love or dislike of characters, of that language, of picking up that language, you use it so, so beautifully and skillfully throughout your collection. So, I mean, I guess it's an ear that you've had to that language since those formative years as well. Is that something you've thought about as you've worked on it?
Well, I think it was, thank you, but also I thought of it as sort of like a kind of cunning attempt to hide that I couldn't produce other kinds of fiction. So yeah. I noticed you do this. My friend Miles Allenson does this. Some people can run the board, so to speak. Some people can produce fiction where they're setting the full scene. They can set the sky and the objects. And I, because of coming out of so much comedy and so much theatre, I don't know, I just didn't feel it was always... The voice-driven things always made more sense to me. I just think because I'd heard more comedy performance and I'd heard more monologue and theatre speech. Mm. And one of the ways that I did end up working through was understanding that it was both a way of getting out maybe what I was wasn't so confident of, that sort of more painterly fiction, like a fuller naturalism, but also that it could become a kind of advantage where, because it set me an interesting technical test, I could, instead of concentrating on what I wasn't so good at, what colour's the sun today, kind of, but more, all right, what can you just tell through voice?
Yeah, yeah.
And once I sort of got to that, I did find more and more that there was a whole tradition of, you know, fiction story, which is told through a voice, a single voice talking, you know, first person from Mark Twain to Salinger up through Foster Wallace. And then what was nice about that too was just working just in that place, just that compartment was then all right, because I began to notice how they do smuggle in detail. You just have to be a bit, you just have to make sure it's something that a person really would say while they're saying other things. Absolutely. And the way in which I could sometimes see writers introducing things that I thought in my little amateur way, I'm like, yeah, but a person wouldn't say that. A person wouldn't go out and say, oh, good morning, I noticed that the X is so Y. It's like, no.
A deliberate world building kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It did impose a kind of good formal discipline, which was, all right, you've found these terms for yourself, so work within them. And that was sort of more or less the technical job all through and trying to keep discipline, not pushing in a bunch of detail that really wouldn't be in that person's mouth.
I think with the detail, as you say, like just fitting in little bits of detail, it becomes even more important than, say, a traditional realist story where you have an onslaught of description of, you know, what, as you say, what the sun's like, what the sky's like of the day. Those tiny details become paramount and can add so much to your story, I think.
Tell me about your management of detail or your thinking about detail. I was struck by the way you use detail. You know what's in that truck cab. You know what's on that. You know that VB's
now.
Did you think about it in a self-conscious way? Did you study other writers using it?
Yeah, so I think that was behind the major leap in my writing, really. For the first decade, as I spoke about before, I had a lot of fantastical, absurdist, comic kind of things. It didn't live and it wasn't real. I came across short story writers such as Peter Carey, you know, the fantastical elements, but with super grounding realities. And in later years, an American short story writer named Stephen Milhauser, who's just forensic with detail. Those stories are real, they live. And for me, as a sort of, you know, you write for so long and then you start gathering stories for our collections. As I started to get some stories down that were okay and get better, just a determination to make the stories real. I want to have the most far out stuff that can happen in the stories, like, you know, aliens invading a Victorian town, yes, and placing a bound of footy. But it has to, I have to believe it. I'm not really a fan of, particularly in writing, out and out surrealism so much. The stories have to be real. And so that came down to detail. It also came down to probably lived experience a bit of being able to feel, so not just the detail of descriptions and backgrounds, but a sort of an inner depth to the characters in really far out situations. I think adding depth to characters really grounds a story, and that's something that happens really late in my stories, the first draft or two or three. It's really just that flashy, high concept kind of image driven thing, and over successive drafts it's just the accumulation of detail until trying to get this weird, crazy structure that I didn't think I could make stand, to make it stand, to pull back the scaffolding, and this thing stands and it's real. And I know that sounds really abstract, but
no.
That's what I'm striving for in all the stories.
So in one story, a Yowie walks down into town. In another story, fishmen appear in the sky. This is maybe sort of too particular a thing to ask, but do you remember a story that gave you, I don't know, was harder to push good detail into? One that ran you a bit harder that way? Was harder to get the detail into?
Harder to get the detail into?
Or that you remember really searching for detail for?
Oh, so look, there's a story, Gibson's Band Ball, about the rise and fall of the sports theme park in 1990s Melbourne. And I wanted the detail to be encyclopedic. Like, the story is probably 5,000 words or a bit more, and at first it was 10. And with the detail, I introduced footnotes, and there were a lot more than what there are now. And I wanted the thing to feel like a theme park within a theme park, like a museum, where there were plaques and there were information everywhere. It was this onslaught of information. And rightly, I pulled it back, and my editor helped me pull it back because it was too much. But just that, I don't know, the footnotes, it buys a reality too, I think. Having footnotes gives it an air, a faux journalistic piece or essayistic piece, and those details, I think people tend to buy. And I think maybe that's what you're doing with detail, is just trying to buy the belief, really. That's what a lot of those details are for, to bring you into a world, to make you think that it's real. So that was, that was an onslaught of detail, that one, more extreme than the others. Yeah.
Nice. So we've got time for this last question back and forth. And the question is this question I sent you, which is good times, right? Because, you know, you talk about, like, you know, the hard time and the things that were difficult, and the way in which writing can be so frustrating, and the way you think something is good and then it turns out to be bad and then you try and make it good. But I think I know the answer to this, because this might be a giveaway, but the last story in the book is partly about this. But what's an example of something where you were working away at fiction and you got a sudden amount of what could be thought of as good luck, where a story idea suddenly sort of that you needed came to you and you were able to run it?
Yeah, absolutely. The last story. So the premise of the last story in my book is, and this is all true, when I signed with a firm press, I only had 37,000 words for the manuscripts, and it needed to go. I needed four stories, 4 months, and it came down to a month or less to go, and I still needed another story. And a story just fell into my lap that I'd been trying to write, a story about an Australian female writer, A, because it interested me, but B, my collection is, it's so male dominated, the characters. I really wanted to do something else for balance. And the story of the Australian female writer that I'd been trying for so long to do, and had run through various concepts that were just too far out and didn't work, it became I brought in the story of my parents break up when I was 15, and that writer became kind of, but not really, my mum. It's hard to describe in such a short space, but that story, I was walking in the street one day and the voice came to me, and I just started typing into my phone. The next day, the first draft was done. A week later, the whole lot was done. And then my stories take months, and that was done in a week, and it fell into my lap like nothing else has before. And I hope it happens again. But I guess you just need to take those experiences for what they are, rather than expect them every time. And that was just totally, totally lovely. How about you, Sean? What about you?
That's extraordinary. That's so cleanly written, that story too. That's pretty nice. That's a, you know, that's, it's almost as if you can get to that point where there's an amount of just honest reporting that you usually protect yourself from. And then look at that. You just almost looked out of the side of your eyes and you just told the lot. It's an extraordinary story. And it's so, there's not a wasted word.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot to me, Sean. So how about you? Have you, what, you know, did you have an experience like that with any, with one of your stories in the collection?
I had one where there were lots and lots of monologues. It was just one voice talking away. And this was like a drawback to the voice method, where I would get trapped in monologue sometime. I would just be producing an amount of talk and then I would come across kind of limits or difficulties. So there's a story in the book called Missy about this lady from Malvern who's trying to get into a private reserve when climate change is really threatening the city and there's starting to be serious water and food shortages. And I had her sort of sitting in her house in Malvern and just talking. And I had a visitor with her and she was saying things like, oh, sit down, darling. And do you want a bit of soya? And I was trying to smuggle in the details of, you know, how the climate change would really be working. But then I couldn't make the story progress because I just couldn't, she just kept on talking, but there wasn't much room for more to happen exactly. She could keep describing things or telling things from the past. And then I don't remember how it happened exactly, but then I was at my friend Thorno's house and I remember one day realizing that the sort of form that would solve all my problems was if she was just sending one email after the other. Then it didn't matter, like I could, one event could take place no matter how long afterwards, the email would say when it was, and all sorts of things could happen in order. Like, I guess it's the old idea of a novel or a short story being written in letters, and then the whatever happens between would sort of take on a life of its own. And every time there's a new email letter, you know, it could start in a quite different place. And it just gave me a bunch of sort of story possibilities and got me out of this, boy, oh boy, is my character stuck in a room problem.
Yeah.
And that was, yeah, so that was like a lovely present. And that did happen in one afternoon where I had my little bit of paper and my little pencil and I rewrote the thing as emails and it didn't stay in exactly the same form, but I did, you know, get my, open a door and walk out of somewhere where I didn't want to be.
And it works so beautifully with the emails. Like, I couldn't imagine that story any other way. It's maybe my favorite story in your collection. It's, I actually heard you read that at the Australian Short Story Festival, Sean, and it was really great.
Well, it's a tribute to us both that we stayed in the damn room for 2 years. I mean, it's true, right, that if you do, no matter what you're doing or what you're not doing, you've got more of a chance for an amount to come get you if you've, you know, been staying in your room all the time.
That's exactly right. I think that's all you can do, even through the hard times of when it really hurts. I don't know about you, but when I'm not writing or when the writing's just not happening, it's not a fun place to be. So to stick that out, I think is the three quarters of the journey right there.
There you go. That's got to be a note to end on.
Well, it's been lovely to chat, Sean.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for doing this and thanks for putting it all together.
I'd love to see you in the flesh soon. I'll give you a hug.
I know. In the days when there's not so much virus, we will meet.
All right. Take care, man.
Thanks, mate. Good to talk to you.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre and our wonderful patrons.
This series is supported by the City of Melbourne through a COVID-19 arts grant.